You're listening to Nubs, a podcast created by music geeks for music geeks. Brought to you in part by 44 North. Now, here's your hosts, Matt Diamond and Chris Nickel.
Welcome to episode 9 of Nubs. My name is Matt Diamond.
And I am Chris Nickel.
And this fine program brought to you by 44 North and
Roland and Boss.
Yeah, and they have some brand new stuff that we're going to talk about to kick off the show tonight. If you are a musician, odds are that you know exactly who Boss and Roland is. It is quite possibly the largest guitar and electronics manufacturer on the planet. We are very excited to have partnered with them. And they have just rolled out some brand new products. In fact, when we were talking to some of the people that are like the head honchos over there, as far as our affiliation goes anyway, they couldn't get back to us because they were so busy dealing with a brand new product line.
Must be nice.
Yeah. Well, it's okay.
It's a good issue to have,
man. It's a good excuse to not want to talk to us, I suppose. And I wanted to start off by talking about loop-based music. And that doesn't necessarily have to be electronic music,
no,
per se.
No.
Although, of course, when you're talking about loop-based music or sample-based music, I always think of things like the Dr. Sample, which was a Boss product back in the day, which evolved into something called the SP-404 and then the SP-555, which is a sampler that Animal Collective used. And I'm a big fan of that band. And then I got my hands on two of them at one point, and then I had to beg my wife's acceptance or forgiveness because at the time, this was a little desktop unit, and I'm going back maybe 5 years ago, that I think I got them secondhand, and it was like $700 each.
That's
now
it's like buying the first microwave, man. It's like $1,200.
My first car was like $400.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the point of this is not to talk about how expensive their products are. The point is to look at the evolution of these products now and to see where we're at now.
Yeah, it's crazy, man.
How they've,
unreal.
They've gotten a little bit smaller, a little bit more user-friendly, and certainly a little bit more friendly in your wallet as well. Now, the RC loop stations have been, I think we're at Evolution 3 or 4. This is a great excuse for us to have them on the show as well, because then they can tell us exactly what's going on and all of the points that I'm making incorrectly on this. But there is the actual loop station, which is a side-by-side pedal. And then that pared down to being a single pedal, and that has evolved from one or two different models that was still the RC, and now there is the RC-202. And as I'm looking at this, it's beautiful. The digital display on it, it looks almost like a couple of little CD decks put together. But this is the brand new one that literally just rolled out about, I think, a week ago.
It was 1 week, yeah.
It was
almost to the day.
Just to look at the one sheet, a compact tabletop looper that could be operated with your hands, two simultaneous stereo phase tracks with dedicated controls and loop status indicators, XLR in on this, which is great, 17 onboard rhythm patterns, including odd measure beats, and USB, which is, of course, the way of the world now for anything. But there's a really awesome little video and a demo that goes along with this, so we'll put this into the show notes. But
awesome.
So when you think of like loop-based music, we've all seen the guy that even plays the open mic that kind of, you know, we'll do one.
Well, I was just going to say, I would love to know what the market share of loop versus the rest of the pedals and Boss, because you can't go to an open stage now without some dude rolling in with a loop pedal.
It's true.
You know, every solo artist now, if you don't have a loop pedal, man, you gotta get it going.
It's true. Yeah, you even see the guys that bring in the single, like the pad that's got a bunch of different samples on it too. But I love seeing, you know, an artist that can build, you know, something from one small phrase, and then by the end of the song, and that goes for vocals too,
absolutely,
right? I mean, because there's the XLR in on it, not only can you start with one simple phrase on your guitar, but before you know it, it sounds like there's literally like seven of you going at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because when we talk about the evolution of these, they used to be, and I'm not talking about a Boss specific product, but there used to be these, you know, one that
you're holding your hands out like
this big, bigger than this console right here. There used to be one from a company called Boomerang back in the day, and my old roommate had one. I'm not lying, it was about 3 feet long, this thing, and it was heavy as all get out, but it was crazy. I don't usually say things like that. That was an old person thing to say right there. But it was really heavy and clunky. And now when you see them, and especially when you see this brand new 202 or whatever, it looks just really sleek, and the design is modern looking. it's flashy, mm-hmm. and it kind of just looks like the future. And this is like literally the case that it is the future of looping technologies here. And if again, if you haven't seen this yet, we'll put it in the show notes. But so excited because not only is this a new product from our standpoint of the show, but Boss rolling out some brand new products. And because of our affiliation with them, we're going to try to get some more, you know, reps on the show, talk about some of their artists that are using some of their gear, and then have them kind of school everybody else as far as some of the specifics with the new gear.
Absolutely, man. Go to the source.
Something happened, well, let's see, within the last episode, we have had not only the Masters have come and gone, because you and I are kind of nerds as far as the sports world goes, too, but we have finally got baseball back as well. Dude, you're rocking the Blue Jays cap now.
It's been on nonstop, man. I'm sleeping with this hat.
Mine's in my office, actually, just down the hall right now.
My wife's so happy.
I bet she is, yeah, because when baseball season comes around, it's really your other marriage.
Yeah.
She loses a piece of you every year. I wanted to touch real – I thought this was kind of a cool little connection to make. Not only is there a great band by the name of Modern Baseball. I don't know if you know that band. But they're a pretty great band, yeah. But there are, of course, some athletes that have turned into musicians and vice versa. And when I think of, you know, especially baseball and specifically because you and I mean, when we first met, we started talking, you know, about Blue Jays baseball right off the bat. And – we've had Nick Harmer from Death Cab for Cutie on the show, and if you remember that episode, I was talking to him about Mariners ball because Ben
shit talking Ben about the Mariners and the Mariners.
And Ben Gibbard is a huge baseball fan, and he's thrown out the pitch at a bunch of Seattle games too.
What's the name of that field? Safeco or something? I think it's Safeco.
It's Safeco. And Ben Bridwell from Band of Horses just threw out the pitch at a Philly game. I think. I don't even really know what that affiliation is for because he's not from there. I think he's a North Carolina boy. But I know that those guys are big baseball fans too, which is kind of cool.
The Phillies are terrible this year.
Are they?
Oh, yeah.
I see, this is it. As far as any of my my love for any of the teams go, or at least for a specific sport, like I'll watch Leaf hockey, but I could care less about any other hockey.
Oh, okay.
And I love, actually, basketball, I'll watch anything as far as basketball goes. In fact, there's some of the guys on this list. Did you know, okay, so you'll probably know this name here. Did you know that Wayman Tisdale, so he was, I forget what team he played for, but he was a basketball player back in the day. This dude is a jazz bassist.
Really?
This dude went from playing in the NBA to playing on stage and playing bass.
Unreal.
And I think that's really cool. Eddie Vedder, huge baseball fan. And massive. How many times have you seen the footage of Eddie up in the booth singing take me out to the ball game?
He's thrown a couple pitches out too at the Cubbies. He's originally from Chicago, right? So he's a diehard Cubs fan. And you never see him at Mariners games ever, even though he's a defected Seattleite.
Seattleite? Yeah. That's what I was going to say too. John McEnroe as well. Of course, you know him for flipping his lid playing tennis. He's a guitar player as well, which I thought was kind of funny. And I had one more. We were talking Geddy Lee from Rush. And it's funny, that name has come up a few different times on the show. And I'm not going to lie, I don't care for Rush very much.
No.
I don't know why.
How many times a day do you have to play that?
I don't know why I would say something like I'm not a huge Rush fan.
Yeah.
And that's not always the case, too, because I still like Zeppelin. And I got to play that shit every day. I'll still listen to Zeppelin or Pink Floyd any day. But with Rush, it's an acquired taste.
Did you get Alex Lifeson yet?
I have not yet.
No, there's man, gonna be he won't return my calls.
There's going to be some people that are not too happy with me right now. But you know what?
But no, Geddy sits like almost, I would say 75% of the games, he's at his seats behind the plate the Sky Dome.
Yeah, whenever you're watching, and if you look just behind, well, I guess it's just like just behind the catcher, I guess. But you always see him sitting there.
Right there.
And I always love watching Sportsnet because they'll like pick out some of the other people that are in the crowd. And it's either Geddy Lee or one of the Bare Naked Ladies. Or is that the Jays game? It's like, oh, look, it's Ed from Bare Naked Ladies. Which, ironically, the very first time that I ever saw the Bare Naked Ladies was doing the anthem.
Yeah.
And it was like the barbershop
that
quartet
acapella
back in the day.
One,
remember how they were a huge deal because of, remember Speaker's Corner?
Oh, man.
So for anybody that's listening that doesn't know what Speaker's Corner is, there was this, it was like this booth that was at the like right in front of like Queen or whatever where Much Music was. And you'd go in and you'd just talk shit.
I never stumbled in there drunk.
No, I did once, but I wasn't drunk. I think I was just a kid and I don't know, just ranting about how everything takes batteries or something stupid like that.
You imagine the person that had to vet and go through those
videos, go through all of them?
Imagine.
Now
the
it's
shit you would see.
Now it's a little different. It's funny too because you would pop in like a loony or whatever, and mm-hmm. now it's like everybody can do the exact same thing from their smartphone.
That's it.
And it's one of the reasons why I've tried to pull back from Facebook because it's too accessible now.
It is, man.
I know too much about
Here
you.
Here we go. Here
I know
we go.
Far too much about all of you, but I won't go on that rant. I promise.
He's pulling his jacket off. He's getting into this.
But that was it. Back in the day, it was the Bare Naked Ladies went on Speaker's Corner and they did. I think it was like Bruce Coburn's "Lovers in a Dangerous Time."
It was, yeah.
Which turned into a big single for them or whatever, yeah. And then, yeah, so I don't know how I got from baseball
there
to
you
Bare
go.
Naked Ladies,
there
but I managed to do that.
Anyways,
I?
The baseball season is back. We are excited. The Blue Jays are undeniably the best team in baseball, regardless of their start.
Yeah, and that bullshit call that happened the other night, too. And you know what, odds are, let's face it, odds are that if you're listening to this show, you're probably not tuning in to Knobs for
baseball chat.
But there is a, you know, there is a connection between musicians and sports and stuff. And, well, our first guest for tonight does definitely not have anything to do with that, other than the fact that maybe he's from, was he from Seattle?
He is from Seattle, yeah.
He is born and raised in Seattle, isn't
yep,
he?
Yep.
So when I brought up the fact that Damian Jurado had a brand new record coming out, this is actually a cool connection between some of the other artists that we've talked with. In fact, our last episode when we had Dan Beckner on the show, his band Wolf Parade put out a record on Sub Pop. Mm-hmm. And when he was sitting exactly where you are, I told him that the next guest on the show was going to be Damian.
Yeah.
And Damian,
label mates, man.
Yeah, they were label mates, and I make the connection between a gentleman by the name of Dave Bazan, who recorded under the moniker Pedro the Lion, because not only are they somewhat similar in tone, I suppose even sonically, but they were both kind of on this, I want to say the fringe to this almost like, I don't want to say religious, but there was always these...
I know where you're going, yeah.
These annotations of religion or almost like the backlash to the church within some of the references within their music.
Yep.
And Pedro the Lion was kind of he was a Christian musician before Dave. And the first time that I ever saw Damian Jurado, I think he pronounces it Jurado, but he opened up for Pedro the Lion, who I've seen almost as many times as I've seen Guided by Voices. But I had this connection when I was recording my own record a long time ago, and the dude that was helping me produce my record, the game would be because I would get off at midnight and then we would begin those recording sessions at midnight and go right through until 8 in the morning. And after our session was done, we would be like, okay, so what do you got to play for me? You know, so we would kind of sit back and, you know, smoke and drink and just kind of wind down after the session. And I kept going back to this album from Damian Jurado called Now That I'm in Your Shadow.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really subdued, acoustic, laid-back affair.
Is that a Sub Pop release, that one? Or is that from Secretly Canadian?
I think it's a Secretly Canadian, but yeah. I could be
Most of his
mistaken.
Subdued stuff is. His ambient stuff is from Secretly.
Yeah, because it got a little bit more psychedelic and kind of crazier after a record called I Break Chairs, which was also on Sub Pop. But you know what? Here, I can look at it right now. Now That I'm on Your Shadow, Now That I'm in Your Shadow was the fourth release on Secretly Canadian. In fact, as I'm looking at it, it looks like only three records were put out under Sub Pop. And then it started in 2003. He made the jump over to Secretly Canadian. Now, some quick backstory on Damian Jurado. Same thing. He's from Seattle, Washington. He's released a ton of records, and if I can count them all, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16.
It's unreal.
Full-length records for a guy that I don't think he would be ashamed to say that not a lot of people know who this gentleman is.
No.
And in our, by the way, in 20 EPs and singles, but during our conversation, we talk about how he loves to kind of stay under the radar.
Loves the anonymity.
Yeah, and how some of the things that he can be afforded within his career, meaning from a standpoint of doing things like playing living room shows, and this is something that we talk about. In fact, him and Dave Bazan, formerly of Pedro the Lion, have taken to doing these living room shows.
Unreal.
And it's kind of neat for him to not only to be able to connect with people and to not have to worry about talking over a crowd, which I know that is something
it's
that
tough,
you and I
man.
See every single week, to have someone that tries to play a little bit more of an intimate show. But you're playing in this noisy, you know, bar where people – and Toronto is absolutely infamous for this.
It's the worst, man.
It might be the worst. And I've gone to – I've seen shows, in other places in the States. I used to love to just go over the border, even to Buffalo, to the Continental, and see shows there. I've gone, to Detroit. I've been to, even Buffalo. Or even, the Niagara, the U.S. Niagara Falls side, I went and saw Interpol there before, and the
weird
and
even they'd be playing.
It was, and it was a really small, it was a really cool little small intimate venue too. But even the fans there, I found that they were a little bit more into it. And then like you drive an hour back over here, I don't know what it is. And I know that we have people that are listening from Toronto, and I am one of you.
I'm one of you.
I don't understand why. Yeah. Like, I will clap or get excited at a show and then kind of look around and you almost feel kind of embarrassed. Like, why? I don't understand that. People will just talk through a show. So you can only imagine what it's like when
you're playing that style of music.
Yeah, let alone to be finger picking a guitar, right?
Yep.
And trying to be, I don't think he's doing his best to be subdued, but it's a matter of just really trying to let people in and to have that moment where you can hear a pin drop.
Absolutely.
And here's also the moment where I bring up Elliott Smith again. But I remember going to see Elliott Smith in Washington, D.C. at the Black Cat. And it was so refreshing because it was just dead
silence,
quiet. Yeah. The only thing you could hear was me whimpering in the corner. Or you'd hear me light another joint while I'm in the corner. But it was, so anyway, we talked about that. But it was one of those things that I thought that I wanted to bring up to him because he has started to do these living room shows. And the last time that he played Toronto, which if I'm not mistaken, it was probably 5 years ago now because it was just before he released this record called Maricopa, which I fell in love with too. And we definitely talk about that record. But he played the Drake in Toronto, which is about the size of this room, which is awesome. And it was fairly quiet. There were still some people that were a little chatty or whatever. But I did feel like it was certainly a little bit more of a fitting setting for him, right? He's coming back May 30th. He'll be playing the Garrison in Toronto, which which I think is sold out. But the other thing that's nice about this is that this interview is just on the heels of the release of a brand new record.
Yeah, which has been on nonstop in my office, in my house. It's amazing.
Isn't it awesome?
Yeah.
And it's a continuation, this series that began on February 21st, 2012 with an album called Maricopa. And because I'm pretty sure we don't get into the backstory or the theory behind the records, but here's the thing, is that Maricopa simply started out, it was a dream that he had. And Maricopa is a fictitious place. And throughout the last three records, including this latest one called Visions of Us on the Land, it is basically a continuation of this story of this fictitious place and some of these characters that are they're members of his subconscious, I suppose, or they're kind of like cast members that he kind of dreamed up. And the sound that goes from, you know, even 10 years ago, which is crazy to think that I remember listening, and now that I'm in your shadow was October of 2006. Now that's 10 years ago because this brand new one is, just March of this year. But to see how his sound has evolved and to hear him from this acoustic standpoint right up to this, which is now just this full-blown rock record and really crazy stuff. It's really psychedelic. And, I've talked to him twice. The first time was when I actually met him. And then this time when he agreed to kind of Skype in to do this interview, I was really, really humbled by how down to earth he was. And I got to, I think I probably gushed to him a little bit about listening to that Maricopa album and then kind of just telling him how much, he's been a piece of the soundtrack to my life for a little while. And it's funny because we talk about knobs and how this show is really based on gear and stuff. And he is the absolute opposite of that.
He's simplest, man.
I've asked him about what kind of guitar he plays, and he answers me along the lines of, doesn't matter.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever's given to me, man.
And I've thought about doing things like, how do you demo? What's your studio setup like? As I talk to Doug Gillard from Not a Surf, as he tells me about how he uses this and this plugin, or Jason Lytle, of course, when we were talking, you look at, I brought that up too, about how you look around his living room and it's littered with synthesizers and keyboards and gear, and how his entire home is his studio.
Yep.
Whereas Damien says things like, I have a little cassette recorder and that's how I demo my stuff. And then I
love that shit though, man. It's
the minimalist approach.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. And it's funny though, he loves being a minimalist. He loves the anonymity, but he's worked with some monsters, man. Like Richard Swift has worked on his records, and it's Richard Swift, I believe.
It is Richard Swift,
and bass player with Black Keys, member of the Arcs.
He is a member of the Arcs too.
I'm glad that you big records.
I'm glad that you know that too, because I watched that first Arcs video and I was like, is that Richard Swift? And the first time there was another band that I love, and here's a test for anybody that's listening. If you guys know this band, there's a band called Starflyer 59, which is one of my very favorite all-time bands of all time. All-time bands of all time.
All-time.
Okay, sure. That's a long time. Jason Martin has done work with Richard Swift. Richard Swift has produced his record as well, and they are all friends together with Damian Drado. They were all on another label back in the day called Tooth & Nail. Mm-hmm. And it's just cool to see how they're all in this kind of tight-knit unit. And I remember seeing Damian Drado had a photo of Richard Swift on his acoustic guitar at once. And at one point, I was like, is that Richard Swift? And then got to see that he is now working with him since that Maricopa record. Yeah. And then I got to talk about the production from Richard Swift, too, because he's not one of these dudes that is a really, you know, mainstream, well-known record producer,
No, but he's done some nice records, man.
Yeah, he's got a lot of really, really cool stuff that's kind of a signature sound, a throwback sound.
Any of those secretly Canadian guys, though, like the in-house guys for that label, they're monsters.
And that label has it's a pretty diverse
label,
too. They've been around for a long time, since 96, mm-hmm. as I look at this.
From Indiana, right? I think they're from Indiana.
They are, from Bloomington. And one of your favorite bands, The War on Drugs, has released music through those guys as well, too. But as far as Damian Dorado's time with them, too, he has put out a consecutive record, or a record with them consecutively, give or take a year. For 10 years, which is cool. Other great bands on that label, including like Yesair, Richard Swift, who's actually put out his own stuff too on that, Jens Lachman, Magnolia Electric Company, and of course, I'm just reading stuff right now from Wikipedia.
One of my favorite records from that is, I don't think he's on the label anymore, but we've spoken about this before, David Vanderveld. If you ever get a hold, is it like 05, I believe? There's a tune on that called Nothing No. Find that record. It is gold.
What is that? There was another album by that band that I was after we had that conversation, I went and I was listening to something on you. This is what I do while I'm at a classic rock radio station. I go on YouTube and then I listen to bands that I
indie rock
to.
Bands you've never heard of
that I might actually
find obscure labels and find the
it's weird
small releases.
I don't go on YouTube and listen to Rush when I'm done here, but let's get into it. A very intimate, relaxed Skype chat with the one and only Damian Drado right here on Knobs.
I was met on the road by a face I once knew. Shapeless was his frame and his colors were few.
Hey, Matt.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you very much for making time for this today.
Yeah, man.
Where are you at right now? Are you just at home, obviously?
Yeah, I'm in Seattle.
And doing a lot of press right now? Is that the gamut?
Yeah, it's like pretty much been every day.
So this is probably the last thing that you want to be doing right now, really?
No, it's fine.
Well, this is a wonderful treat because not only, you know, do we get to talk about a brand new record, but this show is about, it's a podcast that's all about in studio and on stage craft. So I'm not going to bore you with, maybe you are or you aren't bored about just talking about the new record, but this is going to be a different spin on things for you, Damian, and I hope that's all right.
Okay. It's fine.
Awesome. So I have followed your career since passing copies around of Ghost of David around my office. And just in retrospect, that was 16 years ago. What's the secret to not becoming bored or eaten up by this industry all these years?
What is my secret?
Yeah. What is your secret?
I think it's just figuring out how to do it your way. And nobody else's way. I mean, that's kind of a cliche answer, but it's honestly, you know, that's honestly, I think, how you or how I've been doing it, or how other artists should be doing it, you know. I mean, just give you a bit of a background, like, you know, I came from the hardcore and punk scene, you know, from the late 80s to 90s, and, you know, all my idols who I looked up to were, you know, labels like Discord and K Records and, you know. So there's always been this, like, I guess sort of a DIY ethic I've always taken. And I think it would continue on, you know, even if I signed to like a bigger major label, which I don't ever see happening ever in my lifetime. But if I did, you know, I don't think I would lose that, you know. I don't think you need to sell yourself short to be successful, you know. And I've learned that time and time again But I've also been very fortunate to see bands in my lifetime who I've known, and some of them were good friends, and they just burned out, you know, and you know, got too big too fast, and I don't know. I consider myself to be a kind of a spectator, so I don't really, you know, I don't really, I'm a spectator. I look at other artists' careers a lot, and just say to myself, I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to do this, you know. A good example of this, I'll give you an analogy.
Sure.
I went to see, this past Halloween, my son and I went to go see this double feature, and it was the original 1930s classic Dracula with mm-hmm. Bela Lugosi. Mm-hmm. Directly after that was shown, they played Dracula, which is the Mexican version, Spanish version of Dracula. Now, it was shot by an American director, but he was hired by a Mexican film company to shoot it. It was shot on the exact same day as in time frame that the original Dracula was shot. And it's the exact same, he used the exact same soundstage, props, everything. But what this director was doing was that during the day, he would go and he would sit in on or periodically drop by the Bela Lugosi set to see how the director was doing it. And at night, you know, he would take notes. And then at night, when it was time for him to shoot his movie, his version, he would take those notes and say, okay, they're going to do it this way. I think I should do it this way. Well, his version of the movie ended up being the far better version of the two Draculas. Now, most Americans don't know that because that film was basically buried. The Dracula version was basically buried, and it was found not long ago, you know. Anyways, but that's a whole other different story. I'm going on a tangent here. But point being is that I think I'm a lot like this director who was hired to do the Mexican version of Dracula. I am the guy who's during the day going in and seeing how other people are doing it. And I'm saying, I'm not going to do it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, now whether that's hurt my career, I have no idea. You know, I get fans today who say to me, why aren't you as big as Ryan Adams, or why aren't you as big as, you know, whatever, Wilco, or whatever, you know.
Sure.
You're just as good as these people or these the artists. But then the reality is I've never really wanted to be that big. You know, I've always wanted to be that successful, but I've never wanted to be in the spotlight as much as those bands are. It's just not who I am, you know, personality speaking.
Right.
So the long answer to your short question is really just, you just do things your own way. You just sort of spectate and you say, they're doing this, I'm not going to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's funny to think about how long it has been for you and to see how your crowd has grown. You know, the audience has gotten a little bit bigger. And I do want to talk about a couple of my first memories, not only seeing you, but kind of those first days. But what's your first musical memory, Damien?
My first musical memory, I just asked this question to a fellow musician friend of mine a couple days ago. So it's funny you're asking me this question.
Mm-hmm.
My first musical memory, I was three actually, and in the back of my parents' VW van, side door wide open, and it was December. I know this because it was around Christmas time. And it was dumping snow, and I couldn't figure out why. And this may have been my first thought I remember too. Why is my dad keeping this door open? It's freezing outside, you know. And I'm just sitting there in the back seat. My legs can't touch the floor, you know. I remember all this. I remember what I was wearing. But I remember the first, I remember the song that was coming over the radio, which was The Lion Sleeps Tonight. Mm-hmm. And that was the first, that's my first musical memory.
Did that do something to you? And or like, was there this vibe that kind of went through you thinking, I really like that. I need to do something like that.
I remember just thinking that it sounded otherworldly.
Yeah.
You know, that may have been where, my obsession, I think, with a reverb kind of comes from.
Because
if you listen to that song, and a lot of the songs from that era, you know, they put reverb on everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how we have gotten away from that, you know, I have no idea. And yeah, not to open another can of worms here, but I'm just saying, I think it's my issue with modern music today is that it doesn't sound good.
You mean the actual production techniques, et cetera?
Yeah. Everything sounds compressed. Everything sounds, it's over-compressed. It's just squashed. It's digitized. It's just like, it's just gross sounding, you know? Yeah. To me, it sounds like the equivalent of putting like a mini compact disc in your mouth and trying to chew it, you know?
Yeah.
Or a quarter. You know what I'm saying?
Oh,
or a quarter.
Yeah. It's
it just would be very unpleasant. And that's kind of what it sounds like to my ears, you know?
Well, you know, we are going to move into the studio to talk about you and Richard very, very soon. And how kind of you've brought that resurgence of the old sound, as far as my ears go anyway. And I do want to go there. But, you know, it would be really easy for me to say to you something like, you used to just play an acoustic guitar, now you're full band kind of guy. But that's not true, because even back in 2002 with an album like I Break Chairs, you were plugged in and turned up. Is there a conscious decision of what you want to do before you go to record a record, or does it just happen in studio for you?
It happens in the studio. You know, the only intentional record that was like that was I Break Chairs. Mm-hmm. That was the only intentional record I've ever had. I knew ahead of time that I was going to write an indie rock record. I mean, I knew that like ahead of time.
Right.
So that's really the only record, you know, everything else, they always just start out as acoustic songs being worked out like in the studio for the most part.
Right.
So,
you know, I remember way back in the day, you touring with Dave and Pedro and how excited, I was to finally get to catch you live. Now you guys are, kind of still doing these house shows, you know, this big intimate, you know, connection. What's that experience like for you, man?
I like it, you know, and I've actually talked to Bazan about this quite a few times. You know, Bazan and I actually, we actually played in punk bands as teenagers. We knew kids like Jeremy Green of Modest Mouse, for instance. Mm-hmm. We knew kids in our scene that would eventually become, you know, well-known, tasteful musicians, you know. But, you know, back then, it's like we'd cram 50 to 100 kids in a living room, okay, which would eventually be shut down by the cops.
Yeah, it's so punk.
The noise level. Yeah, I mean, that's really what it was. You know,
right.
Because we couldn't get into, we couldn't go to see our, you know, if, I remember this, for instance, like, I remember when, like, there were a lot of bands that were coming to Seattle that we really wanted to see that would have only played 21 and up shows. And we just were like, okay, well, that sucks, you know, so we have to depend on make our own bands, you know, we got to create our own shows. And so I think that sort of ethic is in the house show mentality. It's saying, kind of giving a finger in some ways to the major club circuits who are taking a percentage of your merch.
Oh,
you
God,
know,
yeah. Yeah.
Who are,
of
who
everything.
Are, you know, also, you know, selling shitloads of alcohol. I don't know. It just, it's an entirely different atmosphere. You know, if you're a guy that plays guitar, or if you're a three or four piece intimate sounding band, because it's a little bit quieter. Why are you playing an overcrowded, smoky, like alcohol filled club? You know what I mean? Where there's gonna be talking over you the entire time.
Yeah.
Why not go to a place where people listen to you? And those are happening in houses. You know, but this dates back way beyond, far beyond the punk rock thing. I mean, you know, in the 1960s, rent parties were a big thing, where poets and jazz, mostly jazz musicians, in New York and in San Francisco were playing rent parties. Mm-hmm. And so they'd play up, you know, it's a person, they're an artist, quote unquote, who would invite a well-known, established underground artist at the time, maybe Allen Ginsberg, maybe Junk, or whatever, you know who it is. And the artist would get a cut, and the person whose house is being hosted at would get a cut to pay their rent. And really cool idea. I've heard stories, I've seen pictures of people like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, you know, who were not allowed to play, who could not get a gig in normal venues because they're blacklisted.
Right.
You know? And those, the alternative was to play house parties. And for me, it's I don't know. It's kind of funny, you know, I've played both worlds. I've played for as many people as, you know, biggest crowd I've ever played for was maybe 2,500 people to 3,000 people. That's because that was in Portland.
Right.
At an outdoor show.
Right.
But I prefer the intimate house shows.
Yeah, because you're about to get on the road and do the full band thing again, and we'll get there.
Yeah.
But I do love the fact that there is that contrast, especially from the audience standpoint. I mean, the last time that I saw you, the last time you were in Toronto, that was a small room, you know, and I can't imagine what it's like to be doing those soft songs, those beautiful, intimate songs, you know, when people are talking through them. I used to go see Elliott Smith play, and I'd be so infuriated because, you know, the I don't want to say I hate hipster, but the guys that are there for everything but the music, and here's this guy pouring his heart out. You know, it's like how do you do that? You know, so I'm sure when you bring it back to the living room or something like that, you probably feel like it's validated again.
But it's funny, you know. I mean, you know, I had conversations with Elliot, the same thing. You know, where he was just like, I would love to go back on an independent label, you know, again. I would love to start playing people's living rooms again, because this is out of control. I'm not even being heard, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've done both worlds, and I gotta say, there's just something that's really great about connecting with your audience that you can't do in a live, big stage that you can do in a house, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's almost like it's probably just feeling like a spectacle almost.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. It's just two
gather around,
you know.
Yeah. Before we get into specifics about the studio, I want to talk about you know, some of your gear maybe that you tour with. Has there been maybe an evolution to the guitars that you play, or are you really particular or loyal to simply playing attack, or does that kind of thing matter to a guy like Damian Jurado?
Doesn't matter to me. I've, you know, for years and years and years, I put an Alvarez guitar, which I just got refinished and done.
Nice.
Because I love it so much. But no, I'm an artist that plays anything. You know, I think so long as it stayed somewhat in tune and it wasn't, you know. I have never been a gear guy, so I'm the opposite of like the guys and my friends who all have home studios. I don't have a home studio, you know. My home studio is a handheld tape recorder, you know. my guitar is currently a Takamine, that was given to me by Takamine. So I'm not going out and buying like lots of lavish cool guitars either. The Alvarez was given to me. I don't know. I'm not really picky about gear or what I play. So,
you know, it's funny because my next question was going to be about your, you know, your personal arsenal of guitars, you know, or what's at home.
Yeah, I'm not an arsenal guy.
That's cool. You know, I talked to Jason Lytle on the show, and we were talking about how his home is absolutely just, his home is his studio. You know, it's just littered keyboards and guitars and amps and stuff. Like, you don't seem to be a pedal guy. You know, you probably just rely on what's in the studio, right?
Yeah. If you went to my, if you entered my house, you would never know a musician even lived here. I keep my guitars in the closet. They're never even out. I never ever touch my guitars unless I'm doing a show, or unless like something comes to me like in a song, like writing wise, I never touch it. And I'll demo it real fast, and I'll put my guitar back in its case, and I'll put it back in the closet.
So the demo process for you is literally like a little Fostex or something like that?
No, it's seriously a handheld recorder.
Oh, okay. All right. So
It's a Radio Shack handheld recorder.
I love it, man. That's great. That's so great. You know, I have so many other people that have been on the show that talk about, you know, Pro Tools this and, you know, Logic. And, you know, just yesterday talking to Chris Taylor from Grizzly Bear, and how if he was on a deserted island, the one toy that he would have to have, I think, would be the laptop. And I think that's probably, this is why we do the show, because to see how polar opposite a guy like you, you know, would be as far as that goes, right?
Same thing with a laptop, though. I mean, you know, I have an iPhone for my work, you know, and it's how I can communicate with journalists and my label. But, you know, it's like I have a laptop, never use it. My laptop sits in my closet for the most part. You know, my laptop is everything that I have is a tool.
Right.
You're talking about like, so I picture my guitar and my laptop as like a shovel and a hammer. I don't have my dirty shovel hanging out in my living room, you know. I don't have my hammer just hanging out on the table. Right. To me, and it's sort of my relationship, I think, with the internet and social media and, you know, computers. They're just tools. They're nothing I live by. Right. You know, I don't need them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I have a landline, you know, but I use my cell phone for work. I have a home phone and I have my work phone. So, and that's it.
Yeah. You know, the traditionalist aspect of, you know, I love the fact that it's a facet of every part of your life, really, let alone, you know, how you record music and it's just who you are. And I think that's really neat, because I just got an iPhone and I was like, oh, wow, you can do other things on your phone other than just call people. I've never been that guy to like, you know, do you have this app or do this or that? And I think that really translates into, you know, not only how we have evolved or maybe taken a step back as far as, you know, being a human being, but that really translates into your music as far as being that, you know, that traditionalist. And I think that's really cool. I love the fact that you're living your, you know, the simple life, which is a good thing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we get caught up
it's very simple.
Yeah. Let's talk about the wonderful Richard Swift. How did that, how did that marriage begin?
You know, that was the label's idea. I had nothing to do with that. You know, they approached me in late 2009 about working with him and about, you know, producing an album. You know, I'd been a fan of his music. I owned his CDs and his records. We had mutual friends in common, but we'd never met. So when the idea came up about him producing an album or us working together, I was like, really? I mean, we're not really alike. Well, but what I quickly found out after conversations with Richard we like the same music. Mm-hmm. We just don't play the same kind of style of music, you know? And us liking the same records was enough, you know? And he posed a great question to me, which is like, you know, you have so many eclectic influences that you, artists that you really, really love. And yet your fans would never know because those influences you don't use in your music, you know? I said, yeah, it's a good point, you know? And he's right. I didn't. I like Sergio Mendez. I like Ray Conniff. I like Captain Beefheart, you know? Why am I not using these eclectic people, you know, my influences? And he's really the guy that really sat me down and said, let's start doing that. Let's create something that's different and new. More so, let's create something that's very you. Because I got to tell you, for years, I felt like a fraud, you know? I was creating music and albums, not to say that the songs weren't heartfelt, because they were, and those songs come from a real place. But I was making records, you know, for good reviews. I wanted to make records that sounded like everybody else, so that I can get good reviews, so I can, you know, be liked by my peers. But my peers, I didn't own their records. I didn't own the publications or read the publications that I wanted to be in. But I thought that's how it was supposed to be, you know? So finally, I made St. Bartlett, and I was like, screw this. I'm not doing that shit anymore. Yeah. You know, like, I'm going to do my own road. Mm-hmm. And Richard helped pave that for me. He was the guy that said, yeah, you can do it. You can do it any way you want. It's your thing, you know? And that's when we really did. I did St. Bartlett, and my world has never been the same since, you know? Yeah. And, you know, Richard says, I came at a good time for him. And I always say, yeah, he came at a good time for me. I challenged him, you know, I made him think about new ways of stretching. That's what we call sound, you know. And, yeah, it's been amazing. I love working with guys like that guy, you know.
Well, I really hope so. It's been unfamiliar territory for your listeners, and you know, it's funny too, because there's almost this theme. Well, I know that there's certainly a theme as far as the last three records go, but this, you know, this enormous sound that is happening, and I get this, I know this isn't a conscious thing, but it's like this Brian Wilson meets this Acid Trip kind of vibe. And I wanted to talk about the sounds that are in your head, you know. Mm-hmm. Is there a trial and error for you, or do you know exactly how to get the sounds from your mind onto tape?
Well, I do. Yeah, I know. I mean, a lot of it is Richard, you know. I just try to explain to him what I'm kind of going for. And then it's like if you said to an architect, I kind of want the building to, you know, like maybe look like this. And the architect will draw it out. He'll say, you mean like this? And you're like, yeah, that's exactly what I want it to look like. And that's our relationship together with Richard and I. So he's really good. He's a great interpreter of my language. And I know exactly what I want to, you know, to sound like. You know, I always say my dream record is a record that nobody would buy. it would sound more probably like it would be unlistenable. I mean, I think a lot of people can say even Pet Sounds is unlistenable. Yeah. Because of the amount of reverb that's on there.
Sure.
You can't decipher instruments. But to me, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, if you can put an entire band, you know, and choir into like a giant like cavern or like a silo, mm-hmm. metal silo, that would just be amazing. And you couldn't decipher who was doing what, or, you know.
All right, well, what's stopping you from doing that? What's stopping you then? Let's do it. let's get everybody into the silo.
Because I don't think anybody would get it. And I understand that there is an element of me where I think I make records for me. But, you know, I love Metal Machine Music. Mm-hmm. I love that record by Lou Reed. Mm-hmm. You know, people hate that album, you know, hate that album. And, you know, I think, man, he's pushing the boundaries there. I don't think there has ever been a more challenging record than that record ever. I cannot think of another record in existence that has been more challenging than that record. And it's music. It is music.
Right.
You know? And I think it's the great, I think it's one of the best albums of all time. Because to me, that's what it's like. It captures, like, that's what my thoughts sound like. That's what my bloodstream sounds like, you know. But with, it sounds like that. But if you took that and you put Metal Machine Music, with it, like, but like you mix in like an angelic choir in a massive like canyon. Mm-hmm. That's what my record I think would sound like.
Have you Do you find that the last three that you have kind of been able to express some part of you that have, you know, that it, to fill that void, I guess, is the
sure. The term. Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, even the label came to me afterward and they were like, this is great. We want to use this as a single. And I was like, okay, awesome. But can you maybe take some of the reverb off for the radio? You know, it's like, no, I don't want to, you know, I don't know.
Dude, the first single.
There's a lot of things how it's done today. I think that are just, it's just awful. It's so awful.
It's soulless. You know?
It's so soulless.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I know.
You know, it's like production companies who are doing a film or a television show. They want to use your song, but we want stems. We don't want the entire song. It's like no one's going, like, you know, it's like if a show is going to use like God Only Knows, you know, they aren't going to Capitol Records and saying, are there stems of this song? No.
Yeah.
It's just God Only Knows. Right. That's it.
Right.
We can't take the reverb out. We can't give you the guitar track only and vocal only or an instrumental track version. This is just a fucking song.
Yeah.
You know? And that's kind of how I feel. It's like, no, this is a complete thing. You know, this is what you're getting. So
thank you for
being you. I hate that answer. Well, that's just not how the industry is today. Well, tough.
Right.
You know, tough.
Well, I'm glad that we still have somebody like you on our side, David, because I work in radio, dude. So I know what this is. It's sad.
Well, it's exhausting.
It is. It is, man. Yeah. But on the brighter side of things, there are moments of clarity like we're having right now. And, you know, speaking of those moments, I do want, this is a personal question. The very first time that they came to you, the label or the people, and you played for them the first single off of Maricopa. What was that conversation like? Because I remember playing that and going,
was it Nothing Is the News?
Yeah, half of the song is that guitar solo, you know, that crazy noodling. Yeah. It's just that, what happened with that conversation? That's just a selfish, you need to answer that for me because I wanted to be in the room.
Well, first of all, it was Richard's idea to put that song first on the album. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow. You think so? He was like, dude, put that song first because like it's so strong and it just says I'm here, you know, I've arrived. And I was like, okay, so we did it. The label, I don't remember if they were into it or not, but I remember them wanting a single. I think it was Richard who talked him into it. I had no part of that discussion. I think that was something that Richard and they had a discussion about. But it happened, and I was like, okay, great, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of the back. That's not a very exciting backstory, but that's the truth.
Well, the thing is that I have passed along. I mean, I've always, you know, championed your music regardless, but I remember passing that record along to people, and it made, like, every one of my best friends, we're all like, that's the record of the year. and we still play that record all the time.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, we play music as well. You know, a few of us are really good, you know, good friends, and we all play music together. And we do this trip where we go to this snowy cottage retreat and record music and set everything up and just let it fly. And that was the that was the same time that that record had come out. And I remember saying, we should probably get some work done. We should probably turn this album off and actually get some work done, because it was on repeat for it still is, but man, I listened to that record nonstop.
That's so funny.
Oh, dude, like we were kind of looking at each other like we should really try to get something done, because I think we played it 5 times in a row. But the new album, Visions of Us on the Land, it actually kind of revisits literally some of those musical movements from Maricopa. Is there still some more of this dreamlike theme that we can expect to hear from you, or is that maybe looking too far ahead, or is this going to continue?
No, this next record, Visions of Us on the Land, will be the last installment of the Maricopa trilogy, I guess. This will be it for that. You know, I lived in it for a long time. It does go back, and it, you know, you'll hear elements of like Silver Timothy on the record, and elements of like Silver Malcolm, and you know, there are lots of nods to previous albums, and it's just because they're all connected. I mean, really, Maricopa, Brothers and Sisters of the Eternal Sun, and Visions of Us in the Land, it could have been one record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, easily. I think if you played them all back to back, without stopping, and it would sound like a complete work. And that wasn't intentional, you know, because I really had no intentions on making Brothers and Sisters of the Eternal Sun. For me, it was just like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm still writing about this, you know, because the songs appeared and I just sort of started writing them. And then, you know, that's kind of like, okay, well, I guess this is like a continuation, you know, of Maricopa. And then this, and it was funny because I talked to the interviewer a couple days ago for this new album, and he said, you said the last time we talked for the last record that there wouldn't be another record. And I said, yeah, I didn't think there would be. That I was not planning on there being a third chapter. And he said, well, what happened? I said, well, again, it's not intentional. The songs just sort of came about, and then the lyrics, I was like, okay, well, maybe I think this is all connected. And that's kind of how the whole thing happened, you know? But I'm at a place where I think I'm more consciously aware now that that there will not be another chapter of the Maricopa thing. I think I'm done with it now. So,
but you've said that before.
Yeah, but I think I'm really serious this time.
Yeah, I believe you. So the tour is getting ready to fire up. I mean, by the time this podcast even reaches you know, people's ears, who knows where you'll be as far as that goes. What's that like, that anticipation for you to be able to? I know you're a family guy. You know, what's that like for you to be able to pack up and say, I'm out of here for a bit?
It sucks. I hate it. You know, I'm fortunate enough to do the next tour with a bunch of friends of mine, which is great. But, you know, yeah, I'm a family guy. I have 2 kids and a very serious girlfriend. And, you know, it's not easy. I'm a homebody. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the kind of person that's, you know, shoes are off by like 5:30, 6 p.m., you know. I don't really go out much anymore. I don't go to shows at all, you know, unless it's somebody I really know or I really, really want to see. Like the last person I saw in concert was Herb Albert, you know.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. It was amazing. Him and then 2 months later, Sergio Mendez came to town as well.
Oh, wow.
So I saw him play. But even those, I'm not going to like rock, indie rock shows. I'm going to shows where there are a bunch of like white hairs, you know?
Yeah.
And it's been, and it's awesome. Cause it's not indie rock. It's not like cool or hip, you know?
Yeah.
These shows are done in a local place, here in Seattle called Jazz Alley, Jazz Club. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't really, I'm a very mellow guy. You know, I don't go out a lot, you know, so I'm 43 years old. I'm not saying that I'm super old. I'm just saying, like, I'm at the age now where it's not really appealing to me to go out and be a part of the scene, I guess. So,
yeah, I mean, you're an old soul, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, it's funny. My wife and I had said the last show that we went to, it was a sit-down show, and I was thinking, man, I didn't think that I wanted to sit down, but this guy's bringing beer to me right in the seat, and I'm kicked back, you know, and I'm like, man, am I at the...
Right.
I think I'm comfortable at my... at the point in my life where it's okay to sit down for a show, you know.
Oh yeah.
It's so rock and roll of me, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Damien, I'm sure you get this all the time, but it is an absolute honor to have you on this show and to have followed your career and to see where you are and that you are still expanding the musical landscape and you have reinvented yourself time and time again. But I got to tell you, this last record, or at least these last three, have been some of the most beautiful experiences that I've had sitting back and listening to a record. And I haven't I haven't said that to a lot of people, and I've been doing this for a little while. So thank you so much for being you. You're just you're a wonderful spirit, man.
I appreciate it, man. And for me, you know, you use the word experience, and that's kind of what I, you know, that's what I hope to, you know, to give people. So time and time again as an experience. So. Well, this, so that means a lot. So, yeah.
This, you know, has been a wonderful experience. So thank you so much. I'm so humbled by you. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
So there it is, our conversation with, I want to call him like folk troubadour, but that is certainly not the case anymore because he is larger than life and as is his brand new record.
I love him.
So how do you really feel?
Sorry, did I say that?
Wow,
out loud?
You sure got to the point.
My bad. My bad.
I love him.
Yes.
Visions of Us on the Land is the brand new one on Secretly Canadian, and just such a cool laid back guy. I kind of feel like I always have this same bookend to any of our interviews, but the plain and simple case with most of the guests that we have on the show is everybody is so cool.
Yeah, they are.
You know,
we've been very fortunate, man.
I don't think that I've had anybody that has been like a diva or anyone that hasn't really wanted to open up. In fact, you know, even as he's talking to us from his living room, and then when he kind of got off the call or whatever, and I got to, of course, like I do with everybody, I love you. I love him. But I got to tell him, and he was like telling me that he had, you know, something to do with like, I got to go get my laundry now or something like that. It was just really down to earth, dude. You know, you don't get the rock star treatment from any of these guys. So I really hope that you guys enjoyed that.
And interview. Dig into his music. Open up Spotify. The whole catalog's on Spotify.
Yeah.
There's a Spotify drop.
Okay. So. Yeah, they can come sponsor the show next. Yeah. That'd be great because it's not going to be a rush.
But it will blow your mind, man. You see the evolution of his music through the Sub Pop era into the Secretly Canadian era.
Yeah.
It's something, and you can tell, not that there would have been pressures from Sub Pop, but you can tell that he was in a different headspace in that time, and you know, with his label mates putting out the music
when you look at that era of when he was putting out records with Sub Pop at like 2000 or even before, I think 99 was the first one, Rehearsals for Departure or whatever, but like that was kind of the tail end of like a band like Mudhoney's career,
yeah,
or whatever, and there was so many of these other noisy bands, Modest Mouse, and you know, other contemporaries like that just didn't sound really contemporary to anything that he did. But next guest on the show, this is really cool because of my connection with the radio station that I work for. I've had the opportunity to get to know the guys in 3 Days Grace really well. And if you're looking at the list of the guests that we've had on this program thus far, you might think of a band like 3 Days Grace and go,
I don't know.
But you know what? The point is that they're really, really down-to-earth dudes, and they are a bigger deal in the States than they are here.
They are. Absolutely, man. And they have been almost since their inception.
Yeah, and they told me that they played like Russia twice. Like, this is a band that live up the street. And
yep.
Anyway, so I wanted to talk to them because when I looked at their gear list, Boss is a sponsor of some of the stuff, and Neil and I have become good friends, and I just said, listen, I would love it if you guys would kind of come in and maybe just have a one-on-one, and I want to have you on the show. So the next episode is going to be more or less kind of a candid sit down with 3 Days Grace, and we're going to talk about what they've been up to and what the plans are. We get into their gear and how Neil had, I believe, okay, please don't get mad at me, is it Pearl? I hope it's Pearl.
I think he plays Pearl.
I think it's Pearl. And how they made him a custom kit. Mm-hmm. And he got to go to the factory, and we've promised him a Vic Firth salt and pepper grinder, or a pepper grinder,
pepper
because
grinder.
They're the best on the planet. That was
and
the first
impossible
thing.
To find. Yeah, they don't exist, people.
That was the very first thing that he said, I'll do it if you can give me one of those pepper grinders. So I said, you will.
It's en route.
Okay. So next episode, and I'm thinking that I have two more guests that I really want to announce that are going to be on the show, but I think we should just trickle them out. We'll just have to wait. Okay, so next show, expect to hear an intimate chat with our good friends from 3 Days Grace.
Beautiful.
Sound good? Everything else good?
Everything's good, man. Busy.
Family's good?
Yeah, family's good. And summer's coming. Patio's
patio
opening.
Season coming. Yeah. And before we wrap, you have another, you got a really cool show that's coming to your bar really soon too, don't you?
I have highs out of the GTA, yep. The Greater Toronto area.
Who just opened up for Modest Mouse last time.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Apple Music just released as one of their favorite tracks of the last month.
Beautiful.
Their single, which is a pretty big deal for these guys.
Yeah, man.
Coming in with a band called Brave Station. We've got Twist out of Toronto.
She's coming back again.
She's coming back. I absolutely loved that project so much for bringing them back.
Awesome.
If you haven't heard this band, Twist, get out and listen to them. They're psychedelic. They're lo-fi. They're tasty.
There was one more show that I'm trying to think of the bill that was...
We have Partner from Sackville, New Brunswick coming in. We've got the Isotopes from Vancouver.
That, yeah. Yeah, as we're talking about baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. The Ballad of Ray Ordonez, man. It's the craziest fucking video for a bunch of kids that should not know who Ray Ordonez is.
No.
But yeah, we've got some fun stuff coming in this spring, summer. So
awesome. So again, don't forget to go check out any of the listings on social over on the website for 44north.com. That is the word 40 and then the number 4. And of course, thanks to our good friends at Boss Roland. And again, as the shows progress, we expect to have them on the show and to be able to talk about other new and exciting products like the RC202. Or the VE8 acoustic singer, and I will leave you with that. But for everybody else, if you want to go check out some of these awesome products, of course, you can just go over to the Canadian site, is roland.ca, and then from Roland, it'll take you to all of the products that both Boss and Roland have. But of course, as well, you could hit bossus.com or simply just Google Boss. But again, we'll put up that 202 Loop Station video over in the show notes. You got to check this thing out, man. It's so cool. So cool. Until next time, this has been episode 9 of Knobs. My name is Matt Diamond.
I'm Chris Nickel.
We'll see you next time. Thanks again.